We said that the phylum Chordata has four characteristics at some point in their life cycle. They have a dorsal tubular nerve cord, a nodal cord central to the dorsal tubular nerve cord, pharyngeal gill slits, and a postanal tail. Within the phylum Chordata, we are actually going to talk about three different subphyla. In our taxonomic hierarchy, if you remember, we had kingdom, actually domain, kingdom, phylum, class, and we talked about a number of different classes within phyla. The subphyla taxon fits in between here, okay, and the subphylum is so it's a taxon that's in between the phylum and the class. We're going to talk about three subphyla. Normally when people think about the chordates, they think about the subphylum Vertebrata, which we're going to talk about here in a few minutes. But there are two other subphyla that I think are important for us to cover, and probably you have never heard of these organisms before. The first is the subphylum Urochordata, which includes the tunicates, or what are sometimes called sea squirts. These organisms look very, very primitive. Just to kind of give you an idea, this is a picture of a tunicate here. And if you were to look at that, and if I hadn't told you that it belongs to the phylum Chordata, where would you classify that organism, you think? Okay, maybe a mollusk, maybe a cnidarian, kind of like a jellyfish. Here's another tunicate here. And again, it looks very primitive. It doesn't look like something that's advanced from an evolutionary perspective, okay? But what happens is, during the tunicate life cycle, at one point they have all four chordate characteristics. They also have an endoskeleton. They also have a pumping heart. They also have deuterostomate development. And so from an evolutionary perspective, they are what we would consider to be a more advanced animal. However, when they are adults, they lose most of those chordate characteristics. So in the larval stages up here at the top of the life cycle, on the top of this picture, we have our dorsal tubular nerve cord, nodal cord, here's the anus, so postanal tail, pharyngeal gill slits. Okay, so it's a chordate. What happens is these organisms in the larval stages live for a very short period of time. Sometimes less than a couple of hours. What they do is they actually find a substrate where they can attach. You'll find these organisms in marine environments attached to rocks or pilings in those marine environments. and they attach to their environment, and then what they do is they develop, their internal structures start to rotate. Eventually, all of their internal structures are going to rotate 180 degrees approximately. So here is the mouth. Once they have rotated, the mouth is pointing upward. And so when they become adults, they become sessile filter feeders. Okay. In the process of having all of their internal structures rotate, what happens is they lose their dorsal tubular nerve cord, they lose their nodal cord, they retain their pharyngeal gill slits, but they also lose their postanal tail. So they lose three of the four chordate characteristics as they become adults. Okay. So at this point, when they're adults, they are sessile filter feeders and look a lot like a sponge or a cnidarian, a very primitive animal. However, notice they do have a complete digestive tract. With modifications, they have a stomach. Another thing that they have that is not shown in this picture, but is shown here, is they have a pumping heart, okay, which is a fairly advanced characteristic from an evolutionary perspective, with a closed circulatory system. One thing's a little bit different about the tunicate heart than maybe our heart. Even though it pumps like our heart, the tunicate heart, in the tunicates, they can have what we call bidirectional blood flow. Our blood flow is always in the same direction, right? The blood comes back from our body, goes to our heart, pumped to our lungs, from our lungs to our heart, from our heart back to our body. In the tunicates, they can pump blood in one direction. A few minutes later, they might turn around and pump the blood in the opposite direction. Okay?
And so they have bidirectional blood flow, even though they do have a closed circulatory system. All right. Any questions about that? But again, they are sessile filter feeders, so they bring water into their cavity. That's where they filter the food out. That's also how they breathe, is using those gills. Okay. Any questions about the urochordates or the tunicates?
What's the advantage to having the reversible blood flow?
Probably the reason why they evolve bidirectional blood flow is because of the way that they respire. The blood system, the circulatory system, is very short, and so if they're pumping in one direction, it probably doesn't really matter if they pump the opposite direction. They're still getting blood directly from the gills. So it's probably more that it doesn't matter than it's an advantage for some reason. Any other questions? So again, some pictures of some tunicates here, okay, and sea squirts. This is the larval stages here, a picture of the larval stage with all four chordate characteristics. Okay, the next subphylum within the phylum Chordata is the subphylum Cephalochordata. The common name for these organisms are the lancelets or Amphioxus. They're both common names. The Amphioxus is actually a genus name of these organisms, but it's sometimes used as a common name as well. The subphylum Cephalochordata are sometimes called the true chordates. And the reason for that is that they retain all four chordate characteristics throughout their entire life cycle. This is a drawing of a lancelet here, or an Amphioxus. And as you can see, this is an adult, but here's their anus, so they have a postanal tail, dorsal tubular nerve cord, nodal cord, pharyngeal gill slits, okay? And so these organisms retain all four chordate characteristics throughout their entire life cycle. These organisms live in sediment at the bottom of freshwater or marine environments, where you find the lancelets, where you find more lancelets than anywhere else, are in estuaries. All of you know what an estuary is? An estuary is where the rivers meet the ocean. Okay, so the water is not as salty typically as the ocean. But here you're looking at a lancelet. These organisms are typically about 6 or 7 inches long, if even that. But what they do is they burrow down into the substrate. You can see kind of the sandy bottom of a stream or of the ocean here. And what they do is they burrow into the sediment, and then they become a sessile filter feeder at that point. They can still get up and move around, but they prefer to sit still and just filter food and water through their body. Okay. This is another lancelet here, okay, or Amphioxus. Again, you can see, these are some mollusk shells, kind of smaller shells. This organism that you're looking at is about that long, okay. But they're sessile filter feeders. But the key characteristic of the cephalochordates is they retain all four of their chordate characteristics as adults, all right? Any questions about that? The last of the subphyla within the phylum Chordata is the subphylum Vertebrata. And this is the subphylum that you're probably familiar with because you belong to this subphylum. But also most of the animals that you come in contact with, or many of them at least, are vertebrates. Okay? So like your birds, your reptiles, what else? Amphibians, mammals, all of those organisms are vertebrates. Now, the thing that's a little bit different about the subphylum Vertebrata is in all vertebrates, remember how in the chordates they always have that nodal cord? In the subphylum Vertebrata, the nodal cord grows up and around the dorsal tubular nerve cord and provides a protective covering. And those structures that are a result of that growth of the nodal cord are what we call vertebra. Usually they're segments of the nodal cord that grows around the dorsal tubular nerve cord. So, for example, in our back, we have a number of vertebrae that protect that dorsal tubular nerve cord. Now this is a pretty important evolutionary advance, because if you have something surrounding your dorsal tubular nerve cord, then it's protected. It's not as easily damaged, and so you can be much more active, you'll move around much more easily. Okay. Any questions about that?
Okay, so the subphylum vertebrata. We're going to talk about a number of organisms within the subphylum vertebrata over the next few days. The first group of organisms that we're going to talk about belong to the class Agnatha. The class Agnatha are what we sometimes call the jawless fishes. Okay, the Agnathans are typically found in marine environments, but there are some that are found in freshwater environments, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Sometimes they have a life cycle where part of their life cycle is spent in freshwater, part of it's found in marine water. But they have no jaw, and that's really what the class name refers to. A means not, Nathal is the jaw, Nathos means jaw, so no jaw is what the class name actually means. So this is a picture of a lamprey here. The two groups of organisms that belong to the class Agnatha are the lampreys and hagfishes. This is a lamprey, and as you can see there in its mouth, it doesn't have an upper and lower jaw. It kind of has a sucking type of a mouth part. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Okay. These organisms, this is a picture of, this is not a lamprey here, this is not a jawless fish, this is actually a bony fish. But here are the lampreys attached to this bony fish, okay? And here's a drawing of a lamprey. So first characteristic of the Agnathans is they have no jaw, okay? Second characteristic is that they have no paired appendages at all, or no rudimentary paired appendages. So you don't see fins, for example, on either side of the body. Now with this bony fish here, you can see a fin here and one here. And if we could see the other side of the bony fish, you would see a fin on the other side of the fish, right? Okay. Most of you have seen fish before. They have paired fins or paired appendages. The Agnathans have no paired appendages. They do have some fins, but they're only found on the dorsal and caudal part of the organism. Okay. Any questions about that? In addition, these organisms have what we call a cartilaginous skeleton, or a skeleton made entirely of cartilage. They have no bone in their skeleton, in other words. Okay. So their vertebrae are essentially made up of cartilage. Now, what is cartilage? Yeah, our ears have cartilage in them. What else?
Nose.
Your nose. So like the cartilage in your nose, it's stronger than the cartilage in your ears, right? In fact, the cartilage in your nose, it's almost as strong as bone, right? Cartilage can be a fairly strong structure, okay, and their entire skeleton is made up of cartilage, right? Another thing you'll notice about the lampreys is they all have these external gill slits, whereas the bony fish here has a covering over its gills, okay? What that indicates to us is if fishes do not have coverings over their gills, they almost constantly have to be moving in order to breathe, because without those coverings over the gills, there's no way to push water across the gills, okay? And so what they have to do is they have to constantly swim or have water currents move past them, yeah.
Are they going to eventually kill that fish?
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions about characteristics? So they have no jaw, they have no paired appendages, they have a cartilaginous skeleton, external gill slits. Okay.
So they eat actual fish, not just like
the bacteria? The lampreys, these are lampreys. There's two different groups of organisms that belong to this, to the class Agnatha, the lampreys and the hagfishes. These are lampreys that we're looking at here, and lampreys are parasitic. Hagfishes, on the other hand, are more of a scavenger than a parasite. What you'll find with hagfishes is what they try and feed on is if there's a dead fish in the water or something dead, they'll actually swim into the mouth of that dead fish or sometimes up the anal opening of the dead fish and kind of feed on it from the inside out. So they're scavengers. Okay. Whereas the lampreys, what they do is they actually have a tongue with kind of some bony-like structures on it. It's not really bone, but it's more like our teeth. Also, their jaw, or their jawless mouth, their mouth, I should say, has some tooth-like structures in it. This is looking down the mouth of a lamprey, and I know it's kind of a little bit blurry. You can see these teeth-like structures in their mouth. So what they do is they attach to their host, such as this fish here, and then they'll use their tongue with tooth-like structures on it. What they'll do is they'll rub that tongue against the skin of the host, and they'll feed on those skin fragments and cell fragments of the host. Eventually, they'll work their way completely through the fish and feed on the internal organs of the fish. Okay. Yeah.
How do they hold on to the fish?
Like mostly suction. Yeah. Plus, you saw those little teeth-like structures inside of their mouth, not just on their tongue. And they can actually kind of dig them into the fish. Oh, I'm sure the fish notice it, but how are they going to get them off? I mean, they don't have an arm. They can just reach back and pull them off. The normal life cycle of a lamprey is kind of similar to that of the salmon. Most of you know the life cycle of the salmon, right? They live in fresh water when they're young, and then they go out into the open ocean when they're adults. And that's kind of the traditional life cycle of lampreys. We're going to talk about how that differs in at least the eastern part of the United States today. But notice the larvae looks a lot like an amphioxus. It's a sessile filter feeder in the larval stages in fresh water. As they become more mature, they eventually move out into the open ocean where they feed on fish out in the open ocean. And then they migrate up into fresh water again where fertilization occurs. Now fertilization, these organisms don't have any copulatory organs. Basically what happens is, as you can see, the male kind of wraps his body around the female. As she lays her eggs, the male is going to fertilize those eggs as soon as they leave the female body. Okay. And then, of course, the eggs are going to hatch and have larvae again. Now, this is kind of the traditional life cycle of the lamprey. However, when Europeans started settling the United States, there's one major instance where this life cycle changed quite drastically. And that is with the Great Lakes. Before Europeans settled and started to develop the eastern U.S. and Canada, lampreys could not get up into the Great Lakes. Why?
Channels.
They were cut off. Why? Why were they cut off? You're right.
Yeah,
you didn't have canals. And so what happened is you get someplace like Niagara Falls and they can't get up over Niagara Falls, right? Okay. And so what happened though is when Europeans settled the east, they started digging canals so they could get boats from the Great Lakes out into the ocean, okay, to bypass these large obstacles like Niagara Falls. And what happened is the lampreys started swimming up into the Great Lakes region. And what they found was that there was enough food in the Great Lakes, they didn't need to migrate out in the ocean anymore. And so they started to spend their entire life cycle in the Great Lakes. And around the time of the Great Depression, the fisheries of the Great Lakes crashed. Okay, and the reason behind that was because of an increase in population in lampreys. There used to be quite a few commercial fisheries, both in Canada and the United States around the Great Lakes. Also, sport fishing was big business. But there's times around the 1940s, by the time the 1940s came, there were hardly any freshwater bony fishes in the Great Lakes because of the lamprey problems. Okay. And so the Canadian and United States government has spent billions of dollars trying to get rid of lampreys in the Great Lakes. And they're doing a much better job than they ever have before. Okay. In fact, some of you know Dr. Gardner. That's down the hall here, the older Dr. Gardner. And his father-in-law actually was the research leader on this project of how to get rid of lampreys in the Great Lakes. It's kind of interesting. Any questions about the lampreys or hagfishes?
Do they only attach to fish?
What's that?
Do they only attach to fish?
No. The question is do they only attach to fish? And the answer is no. They can attach to people too. But typically people see them and pull them off.
Okay.
Any questions about the Agnatha? The next class is the class Chondriopthes. The term ichthys, anybody know what that means? Anybody know what an ichthyologist is? An ichthyologist is a person that studies fish. Okay, so ichthys means fish. Chondry means cartilage. So these are sometimes what we call the cartilaginous fishes. Okay. Now we said that the agnathans had a cartilaginous skeleton, but so do the chondriopthes. All right, and you're going to see some examples of chondriopthes here in a minute. Probably the best known of the chondriopthes are the sharks. The chondriopthes include the sharks, the rays, and the skates, as well as the ratfish. Okay, but these organisms are typically found in marine environments. All right. Characteristics, first of all, they do have a jaw, so that makes them different from the agnathans, right? They do have paired appendages, which again makes them different from the agnathans. They do have a cartilaginous skeleton, which does not make them different from the agnathans, right? And another characteristic they have in common, common with the agnathans, is they have external gill slits. So for example, sharks, rays, and skates, they almost constantly have to be moving in order to breathe, or they have to be in a place where water currents are moving past their gills. Alright. Any questions about that? Probably the most distinguishing characteristic of the chondriopthes is they have some structures that line their body and jaw called placoid scales. Did I mention these guys have jaw, right? I said that. They have placoid scales. These placoid scales are actually very similar to a tooth. They actually have enamel on them. However, they don't have roots in them. They're not supplied by blood, or they don't have any nervous system associated with these placoid scales. These placoid scales line the body, and they basically point posteriorly, or to the rear of the body. All right. And as you can see there in this picture, it's kind of an enlargement of those placoid scales and a little spot on the shark. These structures are actually quite sharp. If you take a shark and grab it by the tail, take your other hand and grab the shark really tight and run your hand forward, it can actually cut up your hand fairly severely, okay? Depending on how big the shark is. Typically, the larger the sharks, the larger the placoid scales on the body, okay? But what these placoid scales do is they help to reduce the amount of drag in the water for the shark. And the way that they do this is it basically makes it so that water only passes over certain portions of the body. It's kind of like the keel of a boat. Do all of you guys know what a keeled boat is? Boats, really fast boats like sailboats, they have keels, or their bottoms of the boat, they come down into a point. Why do they do that?
So there's less boat in the water?
Yeah, there's less boat in the water, so it reduces their drag in the water. So when a shark swims through the water, really what's happening is the water is not passing over this part of the skin here. It's just passing over this little tiny bit of keel here on the placoid scales. So the rest of the water, it passes over this area, but there's really kind of a dead water space here. So it makes it more efficient for them to move through the water. You guys, humans have a lot of drag when we're in the water, right? And so we actually can't move through the water very efficiently. Do any of you competitively swim? Okay, nobody does. I'm not a competitive swimmer. In fact, I'm not a very good swimmer at all. But you've all seen competitive swimmers when you get to the Olympic, when they get to the Olympics and so forth, they wear those skin-tight bodysuits. You ever seen those? And actually, the structures on those skin-tight bodysuits, they mimic placoid scales. And for, you know, for me or you, it probably wouldn't make that big of a difference. But for world-class swimmers, wearing those bodysuits with those kind of synthetic placoid scales on them can actually increase their, you know, 100 meter time by, you know, halves of seconds, which for them is a big deal. For us, I wouldn't make that much of a difference, right? Okay. But that's kind of the same principle. They're reducing the amount of drag they have in the water. Another thing is that these placoid scales are even found inside of the jaw, inside of the mouth. Here you can see the placoid scales inside of the mouth. So sharks technically do not have teeth. Okay. something you probably didn't know. They have placoid scales in their mouth, and because they have placoid scales instead of teeth, when they break off, they can actually grow new ones. You all probably knew that, right? Sharks can grow new teeth. Well, technically, they can't grow new teeth because they don't have any teeth at all. But they can grow new placoid scales. Right? So if you have a shark's tooth necklace, it's really not a shark tooth necklace because sharks don't have teeth. It's a shark placoid scale necklace, all right, to be more precise. Any questions about the chondrichthyes? So here we have a typical nurse shark here, and most of you have seen sharks before. Most of the sharks are scavengers or predators in marine environments. Also, the skates, such as this one here, they're more of a scavenger. They can be a little bit predatorial on mollusks, some other invertebrates. But they do have the placoid scales, really thick base at the tail here, which indicates that it's a skate. This is a ray. And again, they're more of a scavenger. These big wings on the skates and the rays, I should mention, are really pectoral fins. So they're these fins that are normally right here on a fish, they're just extra large. That's what they are. Any questions about the chondrichthyes? Okay, the next class is the class osteichthyes. Ichthyes again means what?
Fish.
What does oste mean?
Bone.
If you have osteoporosis, it's porosis or breakdown of the bone. So osteichthyes are the bony fishes. Now most of the fish that you're familiar with are bony fish. Okay. Bony fish are found in freshwater environments and in marine environments. You can find them in either place. Right? Now the key characteristic of the bony fish is that they do have some bone in their skeleton. Okay? That makes them different from the chondrichthyes and from the agnathans. Now some of the bony fish actually do not have a whole lot of bone in their skeletons. There are certain groups of fish that only have bone in their skull, and then the rest of their skeleton is actually cartilaginous. Okay. A good example of that are sturgeons. I don't know if any of you know what sturgeons are. You can actually fish them in the Snake River. But they get very, very large, and they're the fish from which we get their eggs and eat their eggs, which are called caviar. Okay. But sturgeons only have bone in their skull. So they must have some bone in their skeleton. Now, most of the fish that you catch, let's say out in the pond out here, if you were to go fishing out in a pond around here, 9 Mile Reservoir or someplace, most of their skeleton would be bone. They would still have some cartilage, kind of like what we do in our skeleton, right? But most of their skeleton would be bone. All right? Any questions? They have jaws. They have paired appendages, paired fins on either side. So that doesn't make them too different from the chondrichthyes, but they do have some bone in their skeleton. In addition, they do have two additional structures that we don't see in the cartilaginous fishes. The first is what we call a swim bladder, which is right here, internally inside of the coelom. And the second is what we call an operculum, which are gill coverings. Okay. Now these two adaptations have allowed the bony fish to function much differently than the cartilaginous or the agnathans. Okay, the cartilaginous fishes or the agnathans. The first thing that the swim bladder does is it allows the fish to maintain its vertical position in the water. Sharks don't have these, so if a shark quits swimming, what happens to the shark? It actually sinks. Okay. Now, the fish in your fish tank or the trout out in 9 Mile Reservoir, if it quits swimming, is it going to sink? It's not. It can stay in one place all day long in your fish tank, right? And the reason why is because of this swim bladder. It's kind of like having a balloon inside of the coelom. And what they do is, if they want to be higher in the water, they put more air in their swim bladder. And that helps them to float higher in the water. If they want to go down deep in the water, they do what? Take air out of their swim bladder, and then they can be deeper in the water. Does that kind of make sense to everybody? So what the swim bladder does is it allows the bony fish to maintain its vertical position in the water profile. All right. Any questions about that? Operculum, on the other hand, allows the bony fish to breathe while it's stationary. Right? It allows the bony fish to breathe while it's stationary. Yeah.
How does it, being underwater, how does it make the air go into the swim bladder and keep the air in the swim bladder?
It actually does it through its circulatory system.
Okay.
And it's controlled by hormones. The air in the swim bladder is controlled by hormones. So basically, their brain says, we want to be higher up in the water profile. We need more air in our swim bladder, so they'll produce a hormone which allows gases to move from the circulatory system into the swim bladder, fills the swim bladder up more. They want to go lower in the water. Another hormone's produced, which kind of lets the air out of the swim bladder and into the into the circulatory system. Okay. Excuse me. With the operculum, it's a bony covering that covers the gills. Okay, and again, what the operculum allows the fish to do is it allows the fish to stay stationary and still breathe. So, for example, most of you, if I were to ask you, what does a fish do? If I were to ask the elementary school kid, what would they say? How do they act in the water? What would they do? They'd either go, right? So you've seen the fish open and close their mouth, or they would go like this, right? And really, it's a combination of both. The way that they breathe is they actually close their opercula, open their mouth. And when they open their mouth, water goes in their mouth. When they close their mouth, they open their operculum, and with muscles in their mouth, they push the water past the gills so they can breathe. When they close their opercula, open their mouth, get water in their mouth, close their mouth, open their opercula, push water past the operculum. Okay? Any questions about that? So they can basically stay in one spot and still breathe.
Okay? Any questions about the bony fishes? So you're familiar with a lot of different bony fish, Nemo here, or clownfish, right? By the way, this is a sea anemone, which is a cnidarian. Just some aquarium fish. Here you see two different bony fish. You see the catfish here, the goldfish up on top. This is a salmon, which is a bony fish. The seahorses are bony fish. Eels are also bony fish. A lot of times people think eels don't have paired appendages. Their fins are reduced, but look right here. Very small fins. Any questions about the bony fish? This particular bony fish right here is an interesting one. It's called a mud skipper, or another common name for it is a lungfish. These fish actually are only found in Central Africa, Australia, and South America, in certain parts of those countries, those areas, or continents, I should say. And what they can do is their pectoral fins, these fins up on the top here, actually have a piece of bone that sticks out of them. Also, they have a connection between their digestive system and their swim bladder. And their swim bladder is modified kind of as a lung. So what they can do is they can actually breathe on land. Okay? And for short periods of time. The big problem is if they get on land, they have the potential to dry out very, very quickly. They don't have any covering over their skin that prevents them from drying out. But what these fish live in areas where it's wet for about 6 months of the year and dry for about 6 months of the year. What they'll do is as the dry season is coming on, the puddles will start to dry up. So they'll actually get out and crawl from puddle to puddle, get into a new puddle of water. When all of the puddles start drying out, they'll burrow down in the mud and become inactive until the next rainy season. Okay. Any questions about that? So they can actually breathe on land quite efficiently. We believe that these are some of our ancestors, terrestrial vertebrate ancestors here. Any questions about the bony fishes? Okay. The next class within the subphylum vertebrata that we want to talk about is the class Amphibia. The class
class Amphibia, of course, are your what we commonly call the amphibians. These organisms include your Caecilians, frogs, toads, and salamanders, as well as your newts. Okay. So frogs, toads, salamanders, newts, Caecilians, they are all belong to the class Amphibia. Okay. Now the class Amphibia is a little bit different than the other classes that we will talk about this semester, at least in the subphylum Vertebrata. And the thing that makes the amphibians different is they have to spend part of their life cycle in water, and then they can spend part of their life cycle in terrestrial or environments or on land. However, even when they're adults, they can spend most of their life cycle in the water. So these organisms are the first terrestrial vertebrates that evolved, but they're kind of a transitional group. They're not really well adapted to living in terrestrial or in dry land environments. They're kind of adapted to live in both wet and dry environments. That makes sense to everybody. Now, the part of their life cycle that has to be spent in aquatic environments is the immature stages, the egg stages, and in this case, showing in this picture, the tadpole stages. In the amphibia, they do have external fertilization for the most part, at least in the frogs. What you see here is this male has a hold of the female in a position that we call amplexus. Okay. And plexus is just when the male holds on to the female. They do not have any copulatory organs, so the male doesn't have a penis or anything. And what happens is as the female is laying eggs, the male will actually fertilize those eggs as she's laying those eggs. Okay. So it's an external fertilization. If you take those eggs before or after they've been fertilized and take them out of the water, they will dry out almost instantaneously. Okay. So they need to be in the water, at least in the early stages of development. These organisms, actually the thing that makes them the most unique is the way in which they respire, or the way in which they breathe. Amphibians actually have three different ways of respiring. They have what we call cutaneous respiration, okay? They have what we call pulmonary respiration, and they have what we call buccal, pharyngeal respiration, okay? So cutaneous, pulmonary, and buccal pharyngeal respiration. Now the first type of respiration that I'm going to mention of the three is the pulmonary respiration. The pulmonary respiration is respiration by lungs. These organisms have lungs. Okay? So when they're on land, they can use their lungs. However, their lungs, in relationship to their body size, are very small. If you were to expand a frog up to the size of a human, and then look at the size of their lungs versus our lungs, that kind of makes sense to everybody. If you were to do that, their lungs would be about half the size of our lungs. Okay, so they don't have a lot of lung capacity, and there's a reason why. They have other ways of respiring. Okay, so the other thing about pulmonary respiration is they can't use their lungs underwater. I don't know how many of you have tried to use your lungs underwater, but it doesn't work too well. Okay, lungs don't function well underwater. All right. So their pulmonary system is only responsible for respiration when they're in a terrestrial environment. The major way in which they respire, both in water and to some extent on land, is what we call cutaneous respiration. Cutaneous respiration is respiration across the linings of the body or the skin. Okay. So basically, amphibians can breathe across their skin. And so if you chase a frog in the water and you think that it has to come up for a breath of air, it doesn't. Okay? It just breathes across its skin. Even when they're in terrestrial environments, a lot of the respiration occurs across the skin. they have what we call a smooth glandular skin. If you've ever picked up a salamander or a frog or a toad, their skin is kind of smooth, but it's also glandular. It's not really slimy when you pick them up, right? But it's, you can kind of feel, it's almost like when you get really hot or have a fever, you know, it's kind of wet on the outside of their body. And that's so that oxygen exchange can occur across their skin, right? Any questions about that? Now, the third form of respiration actually is just a minor portion of their total respiration, and that's buccopharyngeal respiration. The amphibians can actually breathe along the linings of their mouth and the top of their throat. And so what you'll see a lot of times is if you really stress out a frog, for example, and it jumps in the water, they'll get in the water and they'll open up their mouth. Have you ever seen that before? What they're doing is they're breathing along the inside linings of their mouth. That's buccopharyngeal respiration. Buccopharyngeal respiration is responsible for anywhere from 0 to maybe as much as 4 or 5% of total respiration. So it's just a small part of respiration.
Question? Yeah. Just about, I recently bought a pet frog. I just keep it in a bowl. And there's no like moving water or anything, so does it actually have to keep going up and down for air?
No. I mean, if the oxygen, if you don't put new water in there, still some oxygen transfers from the air to the water, but not a lot. It's probably going to be more terrestrial, set up at the top of the water. One thing about amphibians are sometimes what we call indicator species, ecological indicators in our environment. And the reason why is that because of the way that they breathe. What happens is if amphibians get in polluted environments, there's little pores in their skin that the air's moving across, right? And so if they're in a very polluted environment, what can happen is those pollution particles can get into their skin and clog pores in their skin, which can cause all sorts of mutations. It can even cause death in the amphibians. And so when we get a polluted environment, the very first species to start to die in a polluted environment are the amphibians, okay? So therefore, we consider them to be ecological indicators. If you hear stories about amphibians starting to die, you do need to be concerned, all right? And the reason why is they're kind of the first things to go, and other things are going to follow after this. Does that make sense to everybody? A great example of this is actually in Utah. Most of you know where Utah Lake is, right? Out west of Provo and Orem. In Utah Lake, there used to be about 4 species of amphibians, okay? Also large numbers of fish in Utah Lake. At one point, they put a factory up on the northeast side of Utah Lake called Geneva Still. You've seen the remnants of Geneva Still there. Well, after they put Geneva Still there, it was a huge polluter. And the amphibians started to die off in Utah Lake. Okay. Not only did the amphibians start dying, but eventually fish started to die. And eventually the pollution was so bad that it was even possibly killing humans in Utah County. Okay. Most of you have not grown up with Geneva Still running, but can you remember what it was like when Geneva Still was running and you lived in Utah County? I mean, I lived there in Provo about 14 years ago. And 14, 15 years ago, and I couldn't hardly go out and ride my bike and stuff. Almost any day of the year, there's so much pollution in the air. Okay. The only existing species of amphibian that you find around Utah Lake now, consistently, is found down by Alberta, clear down on the other end of Utah Lake, Genola, Alberta area. Okay. There's actually an endangered or threatened species of fish. The June sucker in Utah Lake probably disappeared because of pollution. Okay. So the point I'm trying to make is that amphibians, when you hear about them dying, you do need to be concerned because, you know, they're the kind of the first group of organisms to die off when an area is polluted. Yeah.
Can pollution cause mutations in the amphibians?
It can.
Because I've heard of like a lake near where I live, where or part of a river that's really polluted, and they had like found frogs with like extra legs and stuff.
Yeah, actually the mutations are not only caused by pollution. Kind of a the mutations of legs and stuff is a little bit more complicated. What happens is when you get pollution, it gets into the water and it causes something that's called eutrophication, or the aging of a stream. As you get aging of stream, then you get more snails. And when you get more snails, then there are more intermediate hosts for trematodes. And when you get more intermediate hosts for trematodes, okay, then frogs eat snails, and so then they get those parasites in their body, and those parasites are actually what causes some of those leg mutations. But it is a result of pollution. It's kind of just a roundabout result.
Okay.
Just kind of give you an idea, just to let you know how serious a problem pollution is. How many of you grew up on the Wasatch Front, Ogden, Provo, Salt Lake area? A little over half of you. Most of you, if you stay in Utah to work, you're going to live on the Wasatch Front, right? Because that's where the jobs are. How polluted is the Wasatch Front in comparison to the rest of the United cities in the United States? It's always in the top 10, one of the top 10 most polluted places in the United States. So something you need to think about in the future. Some years when we have really bad inversions, the Wasatch Front is in the top 2 or 3 most polluted environments in the United States to live in. So something to think about. Any questions about the amphibians? Okay, just by way of reminder,